Harper Audio presents Daughter of Fortune by Isabel Allende, translated from the Spanish by Margaret Sayers Payden and performed by Blair Brown. Everyone is born with some special talent, and Eliza Summers discovered early on that she had two, a good sense of smell and a good memory. She used the first to earn a living, and the second to recall her life, if not in precise detail, at least with an astrologer's poetic vagueness. The things we forget may as well never have happened, but she had many memories, both real and illusory, and that was like living twice. She used to tell her faithful friend, the sage Dao Qian, that her memory was like the hold of the ship where they had come to know one another, vast and somber, bursting with boxes, barrels, and sacks, in which all the events of her life were jammed. Awake, it was difficult to find anything in that chaotic clutter, but asleep she could, just as Mama Frisia had taught her in the gentle nights of her childhood, when the contours of reality were as faint as a tracery of pale ink. She entered the place of her dreams along a much-traveled path, and returned, treading very carefully in order not to shatter the tenuous visions against the harsh light of consciousness. She put as much store in that process as others put in numbers, and she so refined the art of remembering that she could see Miss Rose bent over the crate of Marseille soap that was her first cradle. "You cannot possibly remember that, Eliza. Newborns are like cats. They have no emotions and no memory," Miss Rose insisted the few times the subject arose. Possible or not, that woman peering down at her, her topaz-colored dress, the loose strands from her bun stirring in the breeze, were engraved in Eliza's mind, and she could never accept the other explanation of her origins. "You have English blood, like us," Miss Rose assured Eliza when she was old enough to understand. "Only someone from the British colony would have thought to leave you in a basket on the doorstep of the British Import and Export Company Limited. I am sure they knew how good-hearted my brother Jeremy is, and felt sure he would take you in. In those days I was longing to have a child, and you fell into my arms, sent by God, to be brought up in the solid principles of the Protestant faith and the English language." "You, English? Don't get any ideas, child. You have Indian hair, like mine," Mama Frisia rebutted behind her patrona's back. But Eliza's birth was a forbidden subject in that house, and the child grew accustomed to the mystery. It, along with other delicate matters, was never mentioned between Rose and Jeremy Summers, but it was aired in whispers in the kitchen with Mama Frisia, who never wavered in her description of the soap crate, while Miss Rose's version was, with the years, embroidered into a fairy tale. According to her, the basket they had found at the office door was woven of the finest wicker and lined in batiste. Eliza's nightgown was worked with French knots and the sheets edged with Brussels lace. And topping everything was a mink coverlet, an extravagance never seen in Chile. Over time, other details were added. 6 gold coins tied up in a silk handkerchief, and a note in English explaining that the baby, though illegitimate, was of good stock, although Eliza never set eyes on any of that. The mink, the coins, and the note conveniently disappeared, erasing any trace of her birth. Closer to Eliza's memories was Mama Frisia's explanation. When she opened the door one morning at the end of summer, she had found a naked baby girl in a crate. "No mink coverlet, no gold coins. I was there, and I remember very well. You were shivering and bundled up in a man's sweater. They hadn't even put a diaper on you, and you were covered with your own caca. Your nose was running, and you were red as a boiled lobster, with a head full of fuzz like corn silk. That's how it was. Don't get any ideas," she repeated stoutly. "You weren't born to be a princess, and if your hair had been as black as it is now, Miss Rose and her brother would have tossed the crate in the trash." At least everyone agreed that the baby came into their lives on March 15, 1832, a year and a half after the Summers arrived in Chile, and they adopted that date as her birthday. Everything else was always a tangle of contradictions, and Eliza decided finally that it wasn't worth the effort to keep going over it, because whatever the truth was, she could do nothing to change it. "What matters is what you do in this world, not how you come into it," she used to say to Dao Qian during the many years of their splendid friendship. He, however, did not agree. It was impossible for him to imagine his own life apart from the long chain of his ancestors, who not only had given him his physical and mental characteristics, but bequeathed him his karma. His fate, he believed, had been determined by the acts of his family before him, which was why he had to honor them with daily prayers and fear them when they appeared in their spectral robes to claim their due. Dao Qian could recite the names of all his ancestors back to the most remote and venerable great-great-grandparents, dead now for more than a century. His primary concern during the gold madness was to go home in time to die in his village in China and be buried beside his ancestors. If not, his soul would forever wander aimlessly in a foreign land. Eliza, naturally, was drawn to the story of the exquisite basket. No one in her right mind would want to have begun life in a common soap crate. But out of respect for the truth, she could not accept it. Her bloodhound nose remembered very well the first scents of her life, which were not clean batiste sheets, but wool, male sweat, and tobacco. The next smell she remembered was the monumental stench of a goat. Eliza grew up watching the Pacific Ocean from the balcony of her adoptive parents' home. Perched on the slopes of a hill overlooking the port of Valparaiso, the house was meant to imitate a style then in vogue in London, but the exigencies of landscape, climate, and life in Chile had forced substantial changes, and the result was an unfortunate hodgepodge. At the rear of the patio, springing up like organic tumors, were various windowless rooms with dungeon-like doors, where Jeremy Summers stored his company's most precious cargo, which tended to disappear from the warehouses in the port. "This is a land of thieves. Nowhere else in the world does the company spend so much on safeguarding the merchandise as here. Everything gets stolen, and everything we save from the rabble is soaked by winter floods, scorched in summer, or smashed during one of their ungodly earthquakes," he said every time the mules brought new bundles to be unloaded in the patio of his home. From sitting so long at the window overlooking the sea to count the ships and the whales on the horizon, Eliza convinced herself that she was the child of a shipwreck, and not of an unnatural mother capable of abandoning her and leaving her exposed to the uncertainty of a March day. She wrote in her diary that a fisherman had found her on the beach amid the debris of a beached ship, wrapped her in his sweater, and left her at the finest house in the English colony. As time passed, she concluded that this story wasn't bad at all. There is a certain poetry and mystery about what the sea washes up. If the ocean should draw back, the exposed sand would be a vast, damp desert, strewn with sirens and dying fish, John Summers used to say. He was the brother of Jeremy and Rose, and had sailed all the seas of the world, and he would vividly describe how the water gathered itself in sepulchral silence and roared back in a single monstrous wave, sweeping away everything before it. Horrible, he maintained, although at least that gave you time to run toward the hills. While with earthquakes, the church bells clanged, announcing the catastrophe as everyone was scrambling through the rubble. At the time the baby appeared, Jeremy Summers was 30 years old and was beginning to forge a brilliant future with the British Import and Export Company Limited. In commercial and banking circles, he was known as an honorable man. His word and a handshake were as good as a signed contract, an indispensable virtue in a transaction, since letters of credit took months to cross the ocean. For Jeremy Summers, lacking a fortune, his good name was more important than life itself. With sacrifice, he had achieved a solid position in the remote port of Valparaiso, and the last thing he wanted in his well-organized life was a tiny baby to disturb his routine. But when Eliza turned up on their doorstep, he had to take her in because his resolve crumbled when he saw his sister Rose clinging to the babe like its mother. Rose was only 20, but she was already a woman with a past, and her chances for making a good marriage were minimal. In addition, she had totted up her possibilities and had decided that marriage, even in the best of cases, was a dreary business. With her brother Jeremy, she enjoyed the independence she would never have with a husband. She had her life in order, and she was not daunted by the stigma attached to spinsterhood. Just the opposite. She was determined to be the envy of all wives, despite the current theory that when women deviated from their role as mothers and wives, they grew a mustache like the suffragettes. But she had no children, and that was the one affliction she could not transform into a triumph through the disciplined exercise of imagination. Sometimes she dreamed that the walls of her room were covered with blood, that blood soaked the carpet, spattered the walls up to the ceiling, and that she was sprawled in the center, naked and as wild-haired as a madwoman, giving birth to a salamander. She would awake screaming and spend the rest of the day disoriented, unable to rid herself of the nightmare. Jeremy watched her worrying about her nerves and feeling guilty for having dragged her so far from England, although he could not avoid a certain smug satisfaction with their mutual arrangement. As the idea of matrimony had never passed through his heart, Rose's presence solved all his domestic and social problems, two important aspects of his career. His sister compensated for his introverted and solitary nature, and that was why he bore her shifts of mood and unnecessary expenditures with good humor. When Eliza appeared and Rose insisted on keeping her, Jeremy did not dare oppose her or express niggardly doubts, and he gallantly lost all his battles to keep the baby at arm's length, beginning with the first, giving her a name. "We will call her Eliza, after our mother, and she will have our family name," Rose decided almost as soon as she had fed, bathed, then wrapped the baby in her own little blanket.
"We will do no such thing, Rose. Whatever would people say?"
"I'll take responsibility for that. People will say you are a saint for taking in a poor little orphan, Jeremy. There is no worse fate than not having a family. Where should I be without a brother like you?" she replied, conscious of her brother's horror of the least hint of sentimentality. Gossip was inevitable, but Jeremy Summers had to resign himself even to that, just as he accepted that the baby would have his mother's name, sleep all her early years in his sister's bedroom, and create an uproar in the house. Rose spread the implausible story of the lavish basket left anonymously at the office of the British Import and Export Company Limited, and no one swallowed it. But since they could not accuse her of a misstep, they saw her every Sunday of her life singing in the Anglican service, and her tiny waist was a challenge to the laws of anatomy, they said that the baby was the product of Jeremy's relation with some loose woman, and that was why they were bringing Eliza up as one of the family. Jeremy made no effort to defend himself against the malicious rumors. Children's irrationality in general upset him, but Eliza managed to enchant him. Although he would not admit it, he liked watching her play at his feet in the evenings when he sat down in his easy chair to read the newspaper. There were no demonstrations of affection between them. Jeremy went stiff just shaking a human hand, and the thought of more intimate contact sent him into a panic. When the tiny newborn appeared at the Summers home that March 15th, Mama Frisia, who served them as cook and housekeeper, argued against keeping her. "If her own mother abandoned her, it's because she is cursed. Better not to touch her," she said, but she could do nothing to dent her patrona's determination. The minute Miss Rose picked up the baby, Eliza started screeching at the top of her lungs, shaking the house and grating on the nerves of everyone in it. Unable to get the infant to stop crying, Miss Rose improvised a cradle in a dresser drawer and pulled a cover over her while she rushed out to look for a wet nurse. She soon returned with a woman she had found in the market. It had never occurred to Miss Rose to examine her find close up. All she had needed to engage the woman on the spot was one glimpse of huge breasts straining to escape a billowing blouse. She turned out to be a rather dull-witted campesina who brought her baby with her, a poor creature as begrimed as she was. They had to soak that child a long time in warm water to loosen the filth on his bottom and dip the woman's head in a bucket of water with lye to get rid of her lice. The two babies, Eliza and the wet nurses, came down with colic and a bilious diarrhea that rendered the family's physician and the German pharmacist helpless. Done in by the baby's howling, which was pain and misery added to hunger, Miss Rose wept, too. Finally, on the third day, Mama Frisia reluctantly intervened. "Can't you see that woman has sour breasts?" she grumbled. "Buy a she-goat to feed your baby, and dose her with cinnamon tea, because if you don't, she'll be gone before Friday." At that time, Miss Rose barely stumbled through a little Spanish, but she understood the word she-goat. She sent the coachman to fetch one and dismissed the wet nurse. The minute the coachman brought the goat, Mama Frisia lay Eliza directly beneath its swollen udders, to the horror of Miss Rose, who had never seen such a revolting spectacle. The warm milk and cinnamon infusions promptly addressed the situation, however. The baby stopped crying, slept 7 hours in a row, and awoke making frantic sucking sounds. After a few days, she had the placid expression of a healthy infant, and it was evident that she was gaining weight. Miss Rose bought a baby bottle when she realized that when the she-goat bleated in the patio, Eliza began sniffing, looking for the teat. Rose did not want to see the child grow up with the bizarre notion that the animal was her mother. That colic was one of the few upsets Eliza suffered in her infancy. The others were headed off at the first symptoms by Mama Frisia's herbs and incantations, including the fierce epidemic of African measles, carried to Valparaiso by a Greek sailor. As long as that danger lasted, Mama Frisia placed a piece of raw meat on Eliza's navel every night and bound it with a strip of red flannel, nature's secret for preventing contagion. In the following years, Miss Rose made Eliza her play toy. She spent happy hours teaching her to sing and dance, reciting verses her charge memorized with no effort, braiding her hair and dressing her up. But the minute she found another diversion or was felled by a headache, she sent the child to the kitchen with Mama Frisia. Eliza grew up between Miss Rose's sewing room and the back patios, speaking English in one part of the house, and a mixture of Spanish and Mapuche, her Nana's native tongue, in the other, one day dressed and shod like a duchess, and the next playing with hens and dogs, barefoot and barely covered by an orphan's smock. Miss Rose presented her at her musical evenings and took her out in the coach to go shopping or to visit the ships at the dock or to stop at the finest pastry shop for hot chocolate. But she could just as easily spend days at a time writing in her mysterious notebooks or reading a novel without a thought for her protégé. When she did remember her, she would run repentantly to look for her, cover her with kisses, shower her with treats, and dress her up like a doll and take her out for a ride. She devoted herself to giving Eliza the broadest possible education, not overlooking the skills appropriate for a young lady. The day Eliza threw a tantrum because she didn't want to practice the piano, Miss Rose grabbed her by an arm and, without waiting for the coachman, dragged Eliza 12 blocks downhill to a convent. On the adobe wall above a heavy oak door with iron studs, you could read in letters faded by the salt air, "Foundling Home." "Be thankful that my brother and I took you under our wing. This is where little bastards and abandoned children end up. Is that what you want?" Speechless, the girl shook her head. "Then you would do well to learn to play the piano like a little lady. Do you understand me?" Eliza learned to play without either talent or grace, but through dint of strict discipline, could, by the time she was 12, accompany Miss Rose at her musical evenings. She never lost that skill, despite long periods without playing, and several years later, she was able to earn her daily bread in a traveling brothel, an application that had never crossed Miss Rose's mind when she had insisted on teaching her ward the sublime art of music. Many years later, on a tranquil evening as she drank tea and chatted with her friend Dao Qian in the delicate garden they both tended, Eliza concluded the erratic Englishwoman had been a very good mother, and that she was grateful to her for the large spaces of internal freedom she had given her. Mama Frisia was the second pillar of Eliza's childhood. She clung to her full black skirts, followed her around while she did her chores, and in the meantime drove her crazy with questions. That was how Eliza learned Indian legends and myths, how to read signs of the animals and the sea, how to recognize the habits of the spirits and the messages in dreams, and also how to cook. With her prodigious nose, she was able to identify herbs, spices, and other ingredients with her eyes closed. And, just the way she memorized poems, she remembered how to combine them. Soon Mama Frisia's complicated Chilean dishes and Miss Rose's delicate pastries lost all their mysteries for her. She had a rare culinary gift. At 7, without turning a hair, she could skin a beef tongue, dress a hen, make 20 empanadas without drawing a breath, and spend hours on end shelling beans while she listened open-mouthed to Mama Frisia's cruel Indian legends and her colorful versions of the lives of the saints. Rose and her brother John had been inseparable since they were children. In the wintertime, she entertained herself by knitting sweaters and socks for the captain, and he took great pains every voyage to bring her suitcases filled with gifts and huge boxes of books, several of which ended up under lock and key in Rose's armoire. Jeremy, as master of the house and head of the family, had the right to open his sister's correspondence, read her private diary, and demand a copy of the keys to her furniture, but he never showed any inclination to do it. Jeremy and Rose had a no-nonsense domestic relationship, but had little in common except the mutual dependence that sometimes seemed closer to a hidden form of hatred. Jeremy paid for Rose's necessities, but he financed none of her whims and never asked where she got the money for things she wanted, simply assuming that John gave it to her. In exchange, she managed the house efficiently and with style, kept impeccable accounts, and never bothered him with minutiae. She had good taste and effortless grace. She put a polish on both their lives, and her presence was a check to the belief widely held on these shores that a man without a family was a potential malefactor.
"It is man's nature to be savage. It is woman's destiny to preserve moral values and good conduct," Jeremy Summers pontificated.
"Really, brother, you and I both know that my nature is more savage than yours," Rose would joke. Jacob Todd, a charismatic redhead with the most beautiful preacher's voice ever heard on those shores, disembarked in Valparaiso in 1843 with 300 copies of the Bible in Spanish. No one was surprised to see him. He was just one more missionary among the many wandering all over preaching the Protestant faith. In his case, however, the voyage was not the result of religious fervor, but an adventurer's curiosity. With the braggadocio of a high-living man with too much beer in his belly, he had bet at a gaming table in his London club that he could sell Bibles anywhere on the planet. Todd's friends had blindfolded him, spun a globe, and his finger had landed on a colony of the King of Spain, lost at the bottom of the world, where none of his merry cronies had suspected there was life. He soon found that the map was out of date. The colony had gained its independence more than 30 years before, and was now the proud Republic of Chile, a Catholic country where Protestant ideas had little foothold. But the bet had been made, and he was not disposed to turn back. He was a bachelor with no emotional or professional ties, and the outlandishness of such a voyage attracted him immediately. Considering the 3 months over and another 3 back, sailing across 2 oceans, the project turned out to be a protracted one. Cheered by his friends, who predicted a tragic end at the hands of papists in that unknown and barbarous country, and with the financial aid of the British and Foreign Bible Society, which provided him with the books and arranged his passage, he began the long crossing on a ship bound for the port of Valparaiso. The challenge was to sell the Bibles and return within a year's time with a signed receipt for each sale. In the archives of the British Museum, he read the letters of illustrious men, sailors, and merchants who had been in Chile. They described a mestizo people of a little more than 1 million souls and a wild geography of imposing mountains, cliff-lined coasts, fertile valleys, ancient forests, and eternal ice. Chile, he was assured by those who had visited it, had a reputation for being the most intolerant country in religious matters of any on the American continent. Despite that hindrance, virtuous missionaries were determined to broadcast their Protestant faith, and without speaking a word of Spanish or a syllable of the Indians' tongue, They traveled south to where terra firma broke up into islands like a string of beads. Several died of hunger, cold, or, it was suspected, were devoured by their own flock. They had no better luck in the cities. The Chilean sacred sense of hospitality was stronger than their religious intolerance, and out of courtesy, they allowed the missionaries to preach, but gave them little consideration. When they attended the meetings of the occasional Protestant pastor, it was with the demeanor of someone witnessing a spectacle, amused by the peculiar notion that they were thought of as heretics. None of this, however, disheartened Jacob Todd, because he had come as a Bible salesman, not a missionary. In those same library archives, he discovered that since its independence in 1810, Chile had opened its doors to immigrants who had come by the hundreds and settled in that long and narrow land, bathed top to tail by the Pacific Ocean. The English quickly made fortunes as merchants and ships' outfitters. Many brought their families and stayed to live. They formed a small nation within the country, with their own customs, cults, newspapers, clubs, schools, and hospitals. But they did it with such refined manners that, far from arousing suspicion, they were considered an example of civility. The British harbored their fleet in Valparaiso to control the Pacific maritime traffic, and thus from a rude hamlet, with no future at the beginnings of the Republic, Valparaiso had, in less than 20 years, become an important port where the ships that sailed across the Atlantic and around Cape Horn, and later those that steamed through the Straits of Magellan, came to anchor. Valparaiso was a surprise to the weary voyager. There before his eyes was a port with 100 ships flying the flags of half the world. The snow-capped mountains seemed so close, they gave the impression of emerging directly from the sea, and from the inky blue water rose the impossible fragrance of sirens. Jacob Todd never knew that beneath that peaceful-looking surface lay an entire city of sunken Spanish sailing ships and skeletons of patriots with quarry stones tied to their ankles, consigned to the deep by the soldiers of the Captain General. The ship dropped anchor in the bay amid the thousands of gulls shattering the air with their tremendous wings and ravenous screeches. Countless small boats bobbed on the waves, some filled with huge live conger eels and sea bass flopping desperately for oxygen. Valparaiso, Todd was told, was the commercial emporium of the Pacific. In its warehouses were stored metals, sheep and alpaca wool, grains and hides for the world's markets. Several landing boats ferried the passengers and cargo from the sailing ship to dry land. Todd stepped onto the dock amid sailors, stevedores, passengers, visitors, burros, and carts, and found himself in a city boxed into an amphitheater ringed by steep hills, a city as populous and filthy as many famous in Europe. An architectural blunder, with narrow streets of adobe and wood houses that fire could turn to ashes in a few hours' time. A coach drawn by 2 badly abused horses carried him and his trunks and boxes to the Hotel Inglés. They passed sturdy buildings set around a plaza, several rather unfinished-looking churches, and one-story residences surrounded by large gardens and orchards. He at first estimated an area of about 100 blocks, but soon learned that the city was deceptive. It was a labyrinth of alleys and passageways. In the distance, he glimpsed a fishing community where shacks were exposed to the wind off the ocean, and nets stretched like enormous spider webs, and beyond them, fertile fields planted with vegetables and fruit trees. He saw coaches as modern as any in London, barouches, fiacres, and calashes, but also teams of mules driven by ragged children and carts drawn by oxen in the very center of the city. On street corners, priests and nuns begged for charity for the poor, surrounded by a sea of stray dogs and befuddled chickens. He saw women carrying bundles and baskets, children clinging to their skirt tails, barefoot but with black mantles over their heads, and quantities of idle men in cone-shaped hats sitting in doorways or talking in groups. An hour after getting off the ship, Jacob Todd was sitting in the elegant salon of the Hotel Inglés, smoking black cigarettes imported from Cairo, and thumbing through a British magazine long out of date. He sighed with pleasure. It seemed he would have no problems in adapting, and if he managed his funds carefully, he could live here almost as comfortably as he did in London. As he was waiting for someone to come serve him, apparently no one hurried in this country, he was approached by John Summers, the captain of the ship he had sailed on. Summers was a large man with dark hair and skin tanned like shoe leather, who took pride in his reputation as a hard drinker, woman-chaser, an inexhaustible devotee of cards and dice. They had struck up a good friendship, and playing cards had entertained them through long, endless nights on the high seas and stormy, icy days rounding Cape Horn at the southern tip of the world. John Summers was accompanied by a pale man dressed in black from head to toe and sporting a newly trimmed beard. Although the captain introduced the man as his brother Jeremy, it would be difficult to find two more different human beings. John was the image of good health and strength, open, loud, and likable, while his brother had the air of a ghost trapped in eternal winter. He was one of those persons who never seems to be entirely there, thought Jacob Todd, the kind it is difficult to remember because they have no outstanding features. Without waiting for an invitation, the two men joined him at his table with that familiarity of compatriots in a foreign land. Finally, a waitress showed up, and Captain John Summers ordered a bottle of whiskey while his brother asked for tea, in the lingo invented by Britons to communicate with servants.
"How are things back home?" Jeremy inquired.
He spoke in a low voice, almost a murmur, barely moving his lips, his accent rather affected.
"Nothing has happened in England for the last 300 years, the captain answered. "Forgive my curiosity, Mr. Todd, but I saw you arrive at the hotel and could not help but notice your luggage. I thought I saw you had several boxes labelled Bibles. Was I in error?" asked Jeremy Summers.
"No, they are Bibles."
"No one advised us that they were sending another pastor."
"We were 3 months together in that nutshell, and I never made you out to be a pastor, Mr. Todd," the captain exclaimed.
"I confess I am not," Todd replied, hiding his discomfort behind a mouthful of cigarette smoke.
"A missionary, then? I suppose you're planning to go down to Tierra del Fuego. The Indians of Patagonia are ripe to be evangelized. Forget the Araucans, old boy. The Catholics have already reeled them in," Jeremy Summers commented.
"There are probably no more than a dozen Araucans left," his brother added.
"Those people have a mania for letting themselves be massacred." "They were the most savage Indians in America, Mr. Todd. Most of them died fighting the Spanish. They were cannibals."
"They hacked pieces of flesh off living prisoners," the captain elaborated. "They preferred their meat fresh, but then you and I would do no less if someone slaughtered our family, burned our village, and stole our land."
"Excellent, John. Now you are defending cannibalism," his brother replied, annoyed. "In any case, Mr. Todd, I must warn you not to tread on the toes of our Catholic friends. We must not provoke the natives. These people are extremely superstitious."
"Interesting that the beliefs of others are labelled mere superstitions, Mr. Todd. Ours we call religion. Did you know that the Indians of Tierra del Fuego, the Patagonians, are very different from the Araucans?"
"Equally savage, John. Why, they go about stark naked in an insupportable climate," said Jeremy.
"Take them your religion, Mr. Todd. Let's see if at least you can teach them to wear breeches," the captain laughed.
Todd had not heard the bad reports about those Indians, and the last thing he wanted to do was to preach something he himself did not believe in, but he didn't dare confess that his voyage was the consequence of a drunken bet. He replied vaguely that he was thinking of forming a missionary expedition, but that he still hadn't decided how to finance it.
"Had I known, Mr. Todd, that you were coming to preach the designs of a tyrannical god among those good people, I would have thrown you overboard in the middle of the Atlantic."
The waitress interrupted them, bringing their whiskey and tea. She was a young girl who deliciously filled out the black uniform with its starched coif and apron. When she bent down with the tray, she left a perturbing scent of crushed flowers and hot flat iron on the air. It had been weeks since Jacob Todd had seen a woman, and he sat staring at her with a stab of loneliness. John Summers waited until the girl had left.
"Careful, my friend. Chilean women are fatal," he said.
"They do not seem so to me.
They are short, broad through the posterior, and they have most unpleasant voices, said Jeremy Summers, balancing his cup of tea.
Sailors desert their ships for them, the captain exclaimed.
I admit I am no authority when it comes to women. I do not have time for that sort of thing. I must look after my business and our sister, or had you forgotten?
Not for a minute. You always remind me. You see, Mr. Todd, I am the black sheep of the family, a waster. If it were not for our good Jeremy here...
That girl looks Spanish, interrupted Jacob Todd, his eyes still on the waitress, who was now at another table. I lived 2 months in Madrid, and I saw many like her.
Here everyone has a touch of Indian blood, even those of the upper classes. They do not admit it, of course. Indian blood is hidden like the plague. I cannot say I blame them. Indians have a reputation for being filthy, drunken, and lazy. The government is trying to improve the race by importing European immigrants. Did you know, Mr. Todd, that in the South they are giving away land to colonists?
A favourite sport is killing Indians to take away their lands.
You exaggerate, John.
You don't always have to shoot them. Giving them alcohol will do it. But killing them is much more entertaining, of course. In any case, we English do not indulge in that pastime, Mr. Todd. We're not interested in land. Why plant potatoes if we can make a fortune without taking off our gloves?
There is no dearth of opportunities here for an enterprising man. There is much to be done in this country. If you want to prosper, dear fellow, head north. There you find silver, copper, nitrates, guano.
Guano?
Bird shit, Mr. Todd, laughed the captain.
I know nothing about that, Mr. Summers.
Mr. Todd is not interested in making a fortune, Jeremy. His interest is the Christian faith, right?
The Protestant colony here is large and prosperous. They will help you. Come to my home tomorrow. On Wednesdays, my sister Rose organizes a little musicale. It will be a good opportunity for you to meet the right people.
I shall send my coach to pick you up at 5 in the evening.
You will enjoy it, said Jeremy Summers, excusing himself. The next day, refreshed by a night free of dreams and a long bath that removed the coating of salt clinging to his soul, but not the weaving step of the ocean traveler, Jacob Todd went out to stroll through the port. He walked slowly along the main street, which was parallel to the ocean and so close to the shore that it was splashed by the waves, had a few drinks in a cafe, and ate in a tavern in the market. He had left England in the middle of an icy February winter, and after crossing an endless desert of water and stars in which he was embroiled even in the count of his lost loves, had reached the southern hemisphere at the beginning of June and another merciless winter. Before he left, it had not occurred to him to inquire about the climate. He imagined a Chile as warm and humid as India, because that was what one expected of poor countries. Instead, he found himself at the mercy of an icy wind that blasted his bones and lifted whirlwinds of sand and trash. He got lost more than once in twisting streets and made turn after turn to get back to where he had begun. He climbed infinite stairs up tortuous alleyways bordered with houses absurdly suspended in midair, trying politely not to stare through windows and invade the privacy of others. He stumbled upon romantic plazas reminiscent of Europe, with bandstands where military ensembles were playing music for lovers, and walked through modest gardens trampled by burros. Lordly trees grew at the edge of the principal streets, nourished by fetid waters that poured down from the hills in open ditches. In the commercial zone, the presence of the British was so evident that one breathed an illusory air of other latitudes. Signs on several shops were in English, and he passed compatriots dressed in the mode of London fashion, even to the same black undertaker's umbrellas. The moment he was out of the center, poverty met him like a slap in the face. People looked undernourished, sleepy. He saw soldiers in threadbare uniforms and beggars in the doorways of the churches. At noon, all the church bells began to chime in unison, and instantly the tumult quieted. People in the street stopped. Men removed their hats, the few women about knelt, and everyone crossed himself. This vision lasted as the bells tolled 12 times. Then the activity was renewed, as if nothing had happened. The English.
The fiacre sent by Summers arrived at the hotel a half hour late. The coachman had more than a bit of alcohol under his belt, but Jacob Todd was in no position to be choosy. The driver started off toward the south. It had rained for a couple of hours, and in some sections, mud puddles masked fatal traps that could swallow a distracted horse. Children waited on either side of the street with teams of oxen, ready to rescue bogged-down coaches in exchange for a coin. But even in his cups, the driver somehow avoided most of the potholes, and they soon began climbing uphill. As soon as they reached Cerro Alegre, where most of the foreign colony lived, the look of the city changed abruptly. The shacks and crowded dwellings he'd seen below disappeared. The coach stopped before an estate of generous proportions, but tortuous design, a mishmash of pretentious towers and useless stairways straddling various ground levels, and lighted with so many torches that night was in full retreat. An Indian servant came to the door, wearing livery that was much too large for him. He took Todd's overcoat and hat and led him to a spacious drawing room furnished with good furniture and somewhat theatrical green velvet drapes. The room was crammed with knick-knacks, and there was not an inch of wall space on which to rest the eyes. He assumed that in Chile, as in Europe, a bare wall was considered a sign of poverty. It was only later, when he had visited the somber homes of the Chileans, that he learned better. Paintings leaned outward from the wall so they might be better appreciated, and much of the room was lost in the shadow of the high ceilings. Huge logs were blazing in the fireplace, and several charcoal braziers dispensed an uneven warmth that left his feet icy and his head feverish. Over a dozen people, dressed in the European mode, were standing around as uniformed maids passed trays. Jeremy and John Summers came forward to meet him.
"I want you to meet my sister Rose," said Jeremy, leading him to the back of the drawing room.
At that moment, sitting to the right of the fireplace, Jacob Todd saw the woman who would destroy his peace of heart. Rose Summers dazzled him instantly, not so much for her beauty as for her self-assurance and good cheer. She had none of the captain's gross exuberance, nor the fastidious solemnity of her brother Jeremy. She was a woman with a sparkling expression who seemed always about to break into flirtatious laughter. When she did, a network of fine lines crinkled around her eyes, and for some reason, that was what most attracted Jacob Todd. He could not judge her age. He thought somewhere between 20 and 30. But he imagined that in 10 years she would look the same, because she had good bones and a queenly bearing. She was wearing a peach-colored taffeta dress and no adornment but a simple pair of coral earrings. The most elementary courtesy demanded that he do no more than simulate the gesture of kissing her hand, not actually touching it with his lips. But he was so overcome that unintentionally he planted a full kiss on her hand. That greeting was so inappropriate that for an eternal moment they both stood frozen in uncertainty, he clutching her hand the way you grip a sword, and she regarding the trace of his saliva, not daring to wipe it off for fear of embarrassing the visitor, until they were interrupted by a little girl dressed like a princess. Todd shook off his anguish, and as he straightened up, intercepted a slightly mocking glance exchanged between the Summers. Trying to smooth over his gaffe, he turned to the child with exaggerated attention, determined to win her over.
"This is Eliza, our protégé," said Jeremy Summers.
Jacob Todd committed his second blunder.
"Protégé, I'm not sure I follow you," Mr. Todd said.
"It means that I do not belong to this family," Eliza explained patiently in the tone of someone speaking to an idiot.
"No.
If I do not behave, they will send me off to the Papist nuns."
"What are you saying, Eliza?
Pay no attention to her, Mr. Todd. Children get strange ideas. Of course Eliza belongs to our family," Miss Rose burst out, rising to her feet. Eliza had spent the day with Mama Frisia preparing dinner. The kitchen was at the back of the patio, but Miss Rose had had it joined to the house with a walkway to avoid being embarrassed by serving dishes that were either cold or splattered with dove droppings. That room, blackened by grease and soot, was the indisputable kingdom of Mama Frisia. Cats, dogs, geese, and hens wandered at will across the floor of rough, unwaxed bricks.
There, the goat that had nursed Eliza ruminated through the winter. By now, it was very ancient, but no one would think of sacrificing it, for that would be like murdering one's mother. The child loved the aroma of the dough in the pans as the yeast sighed and worked the mysterious process of leavening. The smell of caramel beaten to frost cakes, the fragrance of mounds of chocolate melting in milk. On Miss Rose's musical Wednesdays, the serving girls, two Indian adolescents who lived in the house and worked in exchange for food, polished silver, iron tablecloths, and made the crystal sparkle. At noon, they sent the coachman to the pastry shop to buy sweets prepared with recipes jealously guarded since the times of the colonies. Mama Frisia always used the occasion to hang a leather bag of fresh milk to the horse's harness, and on the trip back and forth, it was churned into butter. At 3 in the afternoon, Miss Rose called Eliza to her bedroom, where the coachman and the valet installed a lion's paw-footed bronze bathtub that the chambermaids then lined with a sheet and filled with hot water perfumed with mint leaves and rosemary. Rose and Eliza splashed around in the tub like children until the water grew cool and the maidservants returned with arms full of clothes and helped them into stockings and boots, under drawers to the knees, batiste camisoles, contrivances with padding over the hips to accentuate a slim waist. Then 3 starched petticoats, and finally a dress, which covered the body completely, leaving only head and hands exposed. Miss Rose also wore a corset, stiffened with whalebone, and so tight that she could not take a deep breath or lift her arms higher than her shoulders. Neither could she get dressed without help, nor bend from the waist, because the whalebone would break and poke into her body like a knitting needle. That was the one bath of the week, a ceremony comparable only to Saturday's hair washing, which could be canceled on the least pretext, since it was considered dangerous for the health. During the week, Miss Rose used soap with caution. She preferred to scrub herself with a sponge dampened in milk, and to freshen up with a vanilla-scented eau de toilette that she was informed had been in fashion in France since the time of Madame Pompadour. With eyes closed, Eliza could pick Miss Rose out in a crowd by her peculiar fragrance of vanilla pudding. Although over 30, she had not lost that transparent, delicate skin some Englishwomen have before the glare of the world, and their own arrogance, turns it to parchment. She cared for her looks, using rose and lemon water to blanch her skin, witch hazel blossom honey to keep it soft, chamomile to bring out the shine in her hair, and a collection of exotic balms and lotions her brother John brought her from the Far East, where, he said, the women were more beautiful than anywhere else in the universe. She designed dresses inspired by her magazines from London and stitched them herself in the sewing room. Calling on intuition and cleverness, she modified her wardrobe with the same ribbons, flowers, and feathers she had worn for years and yet never looked bedraggled. She did not, like Chilean women, wear a black mantle over her head when she went out, a custom she considered an aberration. She preferred short capes and assorted bonnets, even though people stared at her in the street as if she were a courtesan. Enchanted to see a new face at the weekly gathering, Miss Rose forgave Jacob Todd his impertinent kiss, and, taking his arm, led him to a round table in a far corner of the room. She invited him to choose among various liqueurs, insisting that he try her mistela, a strange beverage of cinnamon, alcohol, and sugar that he could not get past his lips and later, surreptitiously, poured into a flower pot. Then she introduced him to the other guests, Mr. Applegreen, a furniture manufacturer who was accompanied by his daughter, a pallid, timid girl, Madame Colbert, headmistress of an English school for girls, Mr. Ebling, proprietor of the best gentleman's haberdashery in town, and his wife, who latched on to Todd, pressing him for news of the English royal family as if they were her relatives. He also met 2 surgeons, Page and Poet. "These gentlemen use chloroform in their operations," Miss Rose announced with admiration.
"It is still a novelty here, but in Europe it has revolutionized the practice of medicine," one of the surgeons clarified.
"I understand that in England it is sometimes employed in obstetric practice. Did not Queen Victoria use it?" Todd added, merely to have something to say, since he knew nothing about the subject.
Here we encounter major opposition on the part of the Catholics. The biblical curse on women is that they bring forth children with pain, Mr. Todd.
Does that not seem unjust, gentlemen? Man's curse is to toil with the sweat of his brow, but the men in this room, without having to go any farther, earn their living from the sweat of others' brows, Miss Rose rejoined, turning red as a beet. The surgeon smiled with discomfort, but Todd was captivated. He would have stayed by her side the entire evening, even though, as he remembered, correct behavior at a London soiree dictated a stay of no more than half an hour. He noted, however, that in this gathering people seemed disposed to stay, and he imagined that social life must be quite limited, and that perhaps the only occasion of the week was this one hosted by the Summers. He was mulling this over when Miss Rose announced the musical entertainment. The maids brought more candelabras, making the room bright as day, and arranged chairs around a piano, a guitar, and a harp. The women were seated in a semicircle, and the men remained standing behind their chairs. A chubby-cheeked gentleman took his place at the piano, and from his butcher's fingers flowed a delightful melody, as the furniture manufacturer's daughter interpreted an old Scots ballad in a voice so sweet that Todd quite forgot she had a face like a frightened mouse. The headmistress of the school for girls recited a heroic poem, unnecessarily long. Rose sang a couple of raffish songs in a duet with her brother John, despite Jeremy Summers' evident disapproval. And then Rose demanded that Jacob Todd give them the pleasure of a number from his repertoire, which allowed the visitor the opportunity to show off his fine voice. "You are a true find, Mr. Todd. We shall not let you escape. You are sentenced to come here every Wednesday," Rose exclaimed when the applause died down, ignoring the bewitched expression on her visitor's face. Todd felt as if his teeth were sugar-coated, and his head was whirling, whether from his admiration for Rose Summers or the liqueurs he had imbibed and the potent Cuban cigar he had smoked in the company of Captain Summers, he didn't know. In that house, no one could refuse a dish or a refreshment without causing offense. Soon he would discover that this was a national characteristic in Chile, where hospitality was manifested in forcing one's guests to drink and eat beyond the bounds of human endurance. At 9, dinner was announced, and everyone paraded into the dining room where a new series of overly generous entrees and desserts awaited. It was near midnight when the women got up and continued their conversation in the drawing room, while the men drank brandy and smoked in the dining room. Finally, when Todd felt he was on the verge of passing out, the guests began to ask for their overcoats and their coaches. The Eblings, vitally interested in Todd's purported evangelizing mission in Tierra del Fuego, offered to take him back to his hotel, and he immediately accepted, terrified at the idea of being driven through nightmarish streets in the black of night by the Summers' drunken coachman. He thought the ride to the hotel would never end. He felt incapable of concentrating on the conversation. He was dizzy and his stomach was churning.
"My wife was born in Africa. She is the daughter of missionaries who preach the true faith in those lands. We know the sacrifices that entails, Mr. Todd. We do hope that you will allow us the privilege of assisting you in your noble endeavors among the natives," Mr. Ebling said with great solemnity as they bid one another good evening.
That night, Jacob could not sleep. The vision of Rose Summers assailed him repeatedly, and before day dawned, he had made the decision to court her in earnest. He knew nothing about her, but he didn't care. Perhaps it was his destiny to lose a bet and travel to Chile in order to meet his future wife. He would have begun his courtship the very next day, but he was unable to crawl out of bed, having been felled by a violent gripping of the bowels. He lay there a day and a night, at some moments unconscious and at others thinking he was dying, until he could summon enough strength to put his head out the door and call for help. At his request, the hotel manager advised the Summers, his only acquaintances in the city, and called a boy to clean up the room, which stank like a dung heap. Jeremy Summers arrived at the hotel at midday, accompanied by the best bloodletter in Valparaiso, who fortunately had a smattering of English, and who, after bleeding Jacob Todd's legs and arms until he was nearly lifeless, explained to him that all newcomers fell ill when they first visited Chile.
"There's no reason to be alarmed, that I know of.
Very few die, he said to reassure Todd.
He left small rice paper packets of quinine, but the suffering Englishman doubled over with stomach cramps could not get them down. He had been in India, and he recognized the symptoms of malaria and other tropical illnesses treated with quinine, but his sickness did not resemble them even remotely. As soon as the phlebotomist left, the boy returned to take away the rags and wash down the room again. Jeremy Summers had left the address of the doctors Page and Poet, but Todd did not get around to calling them because 2 hours later, a formidable woman appeared at the hotel and demanded to see the sick man. She had by the hand a little girl dressed in blue velvet, white high-button shoes, and a bonnet embroidered with flowers, like a picture in a storybook. They were Mama Frisia and Eliza, whom Rose Summers had sent because she had very little faith in bloodletting. They marched into Todd's room with such assurance that the weakened man did not dare protest. The woman had come in the guise of healer and the little girl as translator.
"My mamita says that she's going to take off your pajamas. I will not look," the child explained, and turned her face to the wall while the Indian woman stripped off his clothes in a trice and proceeded to scrub his entire body with strong liquor. She placed hot bricks in Todd's bed, wrapped him in blankets, and fed him teaspoons of a honey-sweetened bitter herb tea to ease his stomach pain.
"Now my mamita is going to romance your sickness," the girl said.
"What is that?"
"Don't worry, it doesn't hurt."
Mama Frisia closed her eyes and began to pass her hands over Jacob Todd's torso and stomach as she whispered incantations in her Mapuche tongue. He felt a delicious drowsiness creep over him. Even before the woman finished, he was sound asleep, unaware of when his two nurses left. He slept 18 hours and awakened bathed in sweat. The next morning, Mama Frisia and Eliza returned to administer another vigorous rubdown and feed him a bowl of chicken soup.
"My mamita says not to drink any more water. Take steaming hot tea and don't eat fruit, or else you will feel like you want to die again," the girl translated.
Within a week, when he could stand and look at himself in the mirror, Jacob Todd realized that he could not show himself before Miss Rose looking the way he did. He had lost several pounds and was so weak he could not take 2 steps without falling, panting, into a chair. When he was up to sending a note to thank Rose for saving his life, along with chocolates for Mama Frisia and Eliza, he learned that she had left with a friend and her chambermaid for Santiago, a perilous journey given the bad conditions of the road and the weather. Miss Summers made the 34-league trip once a year, usually at the beginning of autumn or in mid-spring, for the purpose of attending the theater, hearing good music, and making her yearly purchases in the Gran Almacén Japonés, an emporium perfumed with jasmine and lighted by gas lamps with rose-colored glass shades, where she purchased the bagatelles difficult to come by in the port. This year, however, there was good reason for going during the winter. She was to sit for a portrait. A famous French painter named Monvoisin had arrived in Chile, invited by the government to establish a school among the nation's artists. The maestro painted only the head. The rest was done by his assistants, and to save time, lace might be applied directly onto the canvas. Despite such ignoble devices, however, nothing was as prestigious as a portrait signed by the French master. Jeremy Summers insisted on having one of his sister to preside over the drawing room. The painting cost 6 ounces of gold, plus an additional ounce for each hand, but this was no time to try to save money. The opportunity to have an authentic work by the great Monvoisin did not present itself twice in the same lifetime, as his clients were wont to say. "If expense is no problem, I want him to paint me with 3 hands. It will be his most famous painting, and someday will end up in a museum, rather than over our fireplace," was Miss Rose's comment. That was the year of the floods, which were immortalized in school children's textbooks and in their grandparents' memories. The deluge swept away hundreds of dwellings, and when finally the storm abated and the waters began to recede, a series of minor tremblers, which came like God's wrath, finished destroying everything that had been softened by the pouring rain. Ruffians scrabbled through the rubble, taking advantage of the confusion to pillage ruined houses, and soldiers were issued orders to summarily execute anyone they surprised in such barbaric acts. Overly zealous in their duties, however, these same protectors began swinging away for the pleasure of hearing their victims yell, and the order was revoked before they began slaughtering innocents. Jacob Todd, tucked in his hotel, nursing a cold, and still weak from his illness, spent hours despairing of the incessant tolling of church bells calling for repentance, reading old newspapers, and looking for a partner at cards. He made one trip to a pharmacy, looking for a tonic to settle his stomach, but the shop was a jumble of dusty blue and green glass bottles, where a Teutonic clerk tried to sell him scorpion oil and pinworm liqueur. For the first time, Todd lamented being so far from London. At night, he was scarcely able to sleep because of drunken parties and quarrels, and because of the daily burials which took place between 12 midnight and 3 in the morning. The new cemetery was high on a hill overlooking the city. The storm washed open graves, and coffins rolled down the slopes in a muddle of bones that equalized all the dead in the same indignity. Many commented that the dead were better off 10 years ago, when decent people were buried in the churchyard, the poor in the ravines, and foreigners on the beach. "This is a truly eccentric country," concluded Todd, who kept a handkerchief tied around his face because of the sickening, wind-borne stench of misfortune, which the authorities fought with great bonfires of eucalyptus branches. As soon as he felt a little better, he went out to watch the processions. Ordinarily, they did not draw a crowd, since they were repeated every year during the 7 days of Holy Week and on other religious holidays. But on this occasion, they had become massive rallies imploring heaven to bring an end to the storms. Long lines of the faithful poured out of the churches, led by the associations of black-clad caballeros, each group carrying a platform bearing the statue of a saint in magnificent robes embroidered with gold thread and precious stones. One column bore a crucified Christ whose crown of thorns lay around his neck. Someone explained to Todd that this was the Cristo de Mayo, the May Christ, which had been brought from Santiago especially for the procession because it was the most miraculous image in the world, the only one capable of changing the weather. 200 years before, a devastating earthquake had leveled the capital, completely destroying the church of San Agustin except for the altar that held this Christ. His crown had slipped from his head to around his neck, where it stayed, because every time they tried to put it back where it belonged, the earth began to tremble. The festivities brought together hundreds of monks and nuns, pious women faint from fasting, humble people praying and singing at the top of their lungs, penitents in coarse robes, and flagellants flaying their naked backs with scourges of leather strips tipped with sharp metal rosettes. Some swooned and were attended by women who cleaned their open wounds and gave them cooling drinks. But as soon as they recovered, they pushed their way back into the procession. Lines of Indians filed by, punishing themselves with demented fervor, followed by bands of musicians playing religious hymns. Mourners' prayers roared like a rushing stream, and the humid air was heavy with incense and sweat. There were processions of aristocrats, richly clad, but all in black and stripped of jewelry, and others of the ragged barefoot down and out, all of whom crisscrossed the plaza without touching or mixing. The more who crowded in, the greater the uproar and the more intense the displays of piety. The faithful lifted their voices, begging forgiveness for their sins, convinced that the bad weather was divine punishment for their failings. The repentant came in swarms, overflowing the churches, and rows of priests were installed beneath tents and umbrellas to hear confessions. The Englishman found the spectacle fascinating. He had seen nothing in any of his voyages to compare to such exoticism and gloom. Accustomed to Protestant sobriety, he felt he had awakened in the Middle Ages. His friends in London would never believe him. Even at a prudent distance, he could sense the primitive shiver of animal suffering that swept in waves through the masses of humanity. With no little effort, he climbed upon the base of a monument in the church plaza, facing the Iglesia de la Matriz, where he could enjoy a panoramic view. Suddenly, he felt someone tugging at his pants leg.
He looked down and saw a frightened little girl with a black mantle over her head, her face streaked with blood and tears. He jerked his leg away, but too late. His trousers were already stained. He swore and tried to shoo her away with gestures, since he could not remember the words to do it in Spanish. He was astounded when the child replied in perfect English that she was lost and that maybe he could take her home. He took a better look.
"I am Eliza Summers. Do you remember me?" the child murmured.
Knowing that Miss Rose was in Santiago posing for her portrait and that Jeremy Summers had not been home because his warehouse was flooded, Eliza had seized the moment and nagged Mama Freesia to take her to the procession until the woman finally gave in. Her patrones had forbidden her to mention any Catholic or Indian rituals in front of the girl, much less expose her to them, but she herself was dying to see the Cristo de Mayo at least once in her life. The Summers would never find out, she concluded, so the two stole out of the house, walked down the hill, and climbed onto a cart that took them close to the plaza, where they joined a column of Indian penitents. Everything would have worked out fine if, in the tumult and fervor of the day, Eliza had not let loose of Mama Freesia's hand, Mama Freesia being so caught up in the collective hysteria that she failed to notice. Elijah shouted to her, but her voice was lost in the clamor of the prayers and the mournful drums of the brotherhoods. She began running around, calling for her Nana, but all the women looked the same beneath their dark mantles, and she kept slipping on cobbles slick with mud, candle wax, and blood. Eventually, the many columns blended together into a single mass that dragged along like a wounded animal, as bells pealed madly and the horns of the ships in the port blared. Eliza had no way of knowing how long she was paralyzed with terror, until gradually she began to think clearly. In the meantime, the procession itself had grown quiet. Everyone was kneeling, and on a platform in front of the church, the bishop, in person, was celebrating Mass. Eliza thought of just starting off toward Cerro Alegre, but she was afraid that she would be overtaken by darkness before she found her house. She had never been out alone, and did not know which way to go. She decided not to move until the crowd thinned out. Maybe then Mama Freesia would find her. That was when she spied the tall, red-haired man clinging to the monument in the plaza and recognized the sick man she had helped her Nana take care of. Without a moment's hesitation, she made a beeline straight for him.
"What are you doing here? Are you hurt?" he exclaimed. "I'm lost. Can you take me to my house?"
Jacob Todd wiped Eliza's face with his handkerchief and checked her over quickly, satisfying himself that there was no visible harm. He concluded that the blood must have come from one of the flagellants.
"I will take you to Mr. Summers' office."
She begged him not to do that, because if her guardian found out she had come to see the procession, he would send Mama Freesia away. Todd set out to find a carriage for hire, not an easy task at that moment, while the girl trotted along, saying nothing, but also not letting go of his hand. For the first time in his life, the Englishman felt a quiver of tenderness as he felt that tiny, warm hand grasping his. Occasionally he glanced at her out of the corner of his eye, moved by the childish face with its almond-shaped black eyes. Finally, they came upon a small cart pulled by two mules, and the driver agreed to carry them up the hill for double the usual fare. They made the journey in silence, and an hour later Todd dropped Eliza in front of her house. She thanked him as she said goodbye, but did not invite him in. He watched her walk away, small and unbearably fragile, covered from head to toe in her black mantle. Suddenly she turned, ran back to him, threw her arms around his neck, and planted a kiss on his cheek.
"Thank you," she said again.
Jacob Todd returned to his hotel in the same cart. Occasionally he touched his cheek, surprised by the sweet yet sad feelings the child had aroused in him. The processions had the effect of heightening collective repentance, but also, as Jacob Todd himself had witnessed, of ending the rains, justifying once again the splendid reputation of the Cristo de Mayo. In less than 48 hours, the skies cleared, and a timid sun peeked out, playing an optimistic note in the concert of current catastrophes. Owing to the storms and epidemics, 9 whole weeks passed before the Wednesday gatherings in the Summers' home were resumed, and several more before Jacob Todd dared hint to Miss Rose of his romantic feelings.
When finally he did so, she pretended not to hear him, but when he persisted, she came out with a crushing response. "The only good thing about marriage is becoming a widow," she said. "A husband, no matter how stupid, always makes a woman look good," he replied without losing his good humor. "Not me. A husband would be an impediment, and he could not give me anything I do not already have. What about children?" "But how old do you think I am, Mr. Todd?"
"No more than 17.
"Do not tease me. It is my good fortune that I have Eliza."
"I am stubborn, Miss Rose. I will never give up."
"I am grateful to you, Mr. Todd. However, it isn't a husband who makes a woman look good, but many suitors." In any case, Rose was the reason why Jacob Todd remained in Chile much longer than the 3 months designated for selling his Bibles. The Summers were the perfect social contact. Thanks to them, the doors of the prosperous foreign colony were thrown wide open to him, and all the English were ready to help him in his proposed religious mission in Tierra del Fuego. He set himself the task of learning something about the Patagonian Indians, but after a few half-hearted sweeps through some heavy tomes in the library, he understood that it made little matter what he knew or didn't know, since ignorance on the subject was universal. All he had to do was say what people wanted to hear, and for that he could rely on his golden tongue. To unload his Bibles among Chilean clients, however, he would have to improve his rudimentary Spanish. With the 2 months he had lived in Spain and his good ear, he learned more quickly, certainly, and also more comprehensively, than many of the British who had come to the country 20 years before him. At first he concealed his too liberal political ideas, but soon he noticed that in every social gathering he was besieged with questions and always surrounded by a group of astonished listeners. His abolitionist, egalitarian, and democratic discourses shook those good people from their fog. They were the source of endless discussion among the men and horrified exclamations among the mature ladies, though inevitably they attracted the younger ones. He was catalogued in general opinion as a kind of harmless lunatic, and his incendiary ideas were considered entertaining. On the other hand, his mockery of the British royal family was badly received among members of the English colony, for whom Queen Victoria, like God and Empire, was untouchable. His income, modest though not to be sneezed at, allowed him to live with a certain ease without ever really having to work for a living, and that classified him as a gentleman. As soon as it was established that he was unattached, there was no shortage of marriageable girls intent on capturing him, but after he met Rose Summers, he had no eyes for other women. He asked himself 1,000 times why she had never married, and all that occurred to that rationalist agnostic was that heaven intended her for him.
"How long are you going to go on tormenting me, Miss Rose? Aren't you afraid I may get tired of chasing you?" he teased her.
"You won't tire, Mr. Todd. Pursuing the cat is much more entertaining than catching it," she replied. The bogus missionary's eloquence was a novelty in those surroundings, and as soon as it was learned that he had conscientiously studied Holy Scripture, he was invited to speak. There was a small Anglican church, frowned upon by the Catholic powers that be, but the Protestant community also met in private homes.
"Whoever heard of a church without virgins and devils?
English folks are all heretics. They don't believe in the Pope, they don't know how to pray, they spend most of their time singing, and they don't even take communion." A scandalized Mama Frisia would grumble when it was the Summers' turn to hold Sunday service in their home. Todd planned to read briefly about the exodus of the Jews from Egypt and then refer to the situation of immigrants who, like the biblical Jews, had to adapt to a strange land. But Jeremy Summers introduced him to the congregation as a missionary and asked him to speak about the Indians in Tierra del Fuego. Jacob Todd could not have found Tierra del Fuego on the map or told why it had the intriguing name Land of Fire, but he succeeded in moving his audience to tears with the story of 3 savages captured by a British captain and taken to England. In less than 3 years, those unfortunate individuals, who lived naked in glacial cold and from time to time practiced cannibalism, he said, went about properly dressed, had become good Christians, and learned civilized customs, including a tolerance for English food.
He failed to mention, however, that as soon as they were repatriated, they had returned to their old ways, as if they had never been touched by England or the word of Jesus. At Jeremy Summers' suggestion, a collection was taken up right there for Todd's plan to spread the faith, with such fine result that the following day, Jacob Todd opened an account in the Valparaiso branch of the Bank of London. The account was nourished weekly with contributions from the Protestants and grew, despite the frequent drafts Todd drew to finance personal expenses when his income did not stretch to cover them. The more money that came in, the more the obstacles and pretext for postponing the evangelical mission multiplied, and in that manner, 2 years went by. Jacob Todd came to feel as comfortable in Valparaiso as if he had been born there. Chileans and English shared a number of character traits. They resolved everything with solicitors and barristers. They had an absurd fondness for tradition, patriotic symbols, and routine. They prided themselves on being individualists and enemies of ostentation, which they scorned as a sin of social climbing. They seemed amiable and self-controlled, but were capable of great cruelty. However, unlike the English, Chileans were horrified by eccentricity and feared nothing so much as ridicule. If only I spoke Spanish well, thought Jacob Todd, I would feel entirely at home. He had moved into the boarding house of an English widow woman who took in stray cats and baked the most famous pastries in the port. He slept with 4 felines on his bed, better company than he had ever had, and breakfasted it daily on his hostess's tempting tarts. He connected with Chileans of every class, from the most humble, whom he met in his wanderings through the poor neighborhoods of the port, to the high and mightiest. Jeremy Summers introduced him into the Club de la Union, where he was accepted as an invited member. Only foreigners of recognized social status could boast of such privilege, since the club was an enclave of landowners and political conservatives whose members' worth was determined by family name. Doors opened to him because of his skill with cards and dice. He lost with such grace that very few realized how much he won. It was there that he became a friend of Augustin Del Valle, the owner of agricultural holdings in that area, and flocks of sheep in the south, where Del Valle had never thought of going, since that was precisely why he had imported stewards from Scotland. That new friendship gave Todd occasion to visit the austere mansions of aristocratic Chilean families, dark square edifices with huge, nearly empty rooms decorated with little refinement, heavy furniture, funereal candelabra, and a court of bloody crucified Christs, plaster virgins, and saints dressed in the mode of ancient Spanish noblemen. These were houses that turned inward, closed to the street by tall iron railings, graceless and uncomfortable, but relieved by cool colonnades, and interior patios filled with jasmine, orange trees, and roses. With the first signs of spring, Augustin Del Valle invited the Summers and Jacob Todd to one of his country estates. The road was a nightmare. A lone horseman could make it in 4 or 5 hours, but the caravan of family and guests started at dawn and did not arrive until late at night. The Del Valles traveled in ox carts laden with tables and plush sofas. Behind them came a mule team with the luggage, along with peasants on horseback armed with primitive blunderbusses to defend against the highwaymen who all too often awaited around the curve of the hill. Added to the maddening pace of the animals were the washed-out track where carts sank to their axles and the frequent rest stops during which the servants served refreshments amid clouds of flies. Todd knew nothing about agriculture, but he needed only a look to realize how abundantly things grew in that fertile soil. Fruit fell from the trees and rotted on the ground because no one made the effort to gather it. At the hacienda, he encountered the same style of life he had observed years before in Spain, a large family united by intricate bloodlines and an inflexible code of honor. His host was a powerful and feudal patriarch who held the destinies of his descendants in his iron fist and made much of a family tree he could trace back to the first Spanish conquistadors. "My ancestors," he would say, "walked more than 1,000 kilometers weighed down in heavy iron armor.
They crossed mountains, rivers, and the world's most arid desert to found the city of Santiago. Among his peers, Del Valle was a symbol of authority and decency. But outside his class, he was known as a rake. He had untold bastards and a reputation for having killed more than one of his tenants in a legendary fit of temper, but those deaths, along with many other sins, were never mentioned. His wife was in her 40s, but she looked like an old woman, tremulous and hangdog, always dressed in mourning for the children who died in infancy, and squeezed breathless by the pressure of her corset, her religion, and the husband fate had dealt her. Male offspring idled away the days in masses, outings, siestas, gambling, and carousing, while the girls floated like mysterious nymphs through the house and gardens in whispering petticoats, always beneath the vigilant eye of their chaperones. They had been trained since early childhood for a life of virtue, faith, and abnegation. Their fate was a marriage of convenience and motherhood. In the country, the party attended a bullfight that did not even remotely resemble the brilliant Spanish spectacle of courage and death. No suit of lights, no fanfare, no passion or glory. Only a handful of reckless drunks tormenting an animal with spears and insults, then tossed into the dust to the tune of curses and guffaws. The most dangerous part of the fight was getting the enraged and ill-treated but still unharmed beast from the ring. Todd was grateful that they spared it the ultimate indignity of public execution, for in his good English heart he would rather have seen the bullfighter die than the bull. In the afternoons, the men played hombre and rocambole, waited on like princes by a true army of humble, dark-skinned servants who never lifted their eyes from the ground or their voices above a murmur. They weren't slaves, but may as well have been. They worked in exchange for protection, a roof over their heads, and a portion of the harvest. In theory, they were free, but they stayed with the patron, however despotic he might be, or however harsh their conditions, since they had nowhere else to go. Slavery had been quietly abolished 10 years before. The African slave trade had never been profitable in these lands because there were no large plantations, although no one mentioned the fate of the Indians who had been deprived of their lands and reduced to penury, or the tenants in the fields who were sold or inherited with the property, like the animals. Neither was there any reference to the shiploads of Chinese and Polynesian slaves destined for the guano deposits of the Chincha Islands. As long as they didn't leave the ship, there was no problem. The law prohibited slavery on dry land, but said nothing about the sea. While the men played cards, Miss Rose grew discreetly bored in the company of Signora Del Valle and her many daughters. Eliza, in contrast, raced through the open fields with Paulina, the one daughter of Augustin Del Valle, who had escaped the languid pattern of the women of that family. She was several years older than Eliza, but that day she romped and played as if they were the same age, faces bare to the sun, their hair blowing loose in the wind as they whipped their horses on.